supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. 5 million people have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and more coming. The incidence is increasing. But what is life really like for them and those that love them and their family caretakers? Later on, we're going to be speaking with Sarah Moss from Abington Hospital about their dementia sensitivity training, and Dr. Gerald Hansen, also from Abington, who treats this population. But first, I recently had a conversation with Michael Ellenbogen, who has Alzheimer's. One way he manages his disease is by advocating for the rights of Alzheimer's patients. Michael, thank you so much for joining us to tell your story today. When you were diagnosed, how old were you?
I was 49 years old when I actually got my diagnosis, but it actually started 10 years earlier.
What started 10 years earlier? What were the first symptoms in hindsight?
Well, as a high-level manager for a Fortune 500 company, I had a lot of responsibility. And I was struggling with some of the simplest and basic things. For example, I was forgetting about the time of meetings or even going to the meetings at the wrong time. I would forget simple four-digit common extension numbers that I was regularly dialing. And most importantly, my direct report's names. I was struggling for their names at times.
How did you understand that, what was happening to you?
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't understand it, and I thought it was a problem. However, most of the people around me said, oh, don't worry about it. That happens to me also, which, you know, we all have those times and moments every once in a while. But I think what we all have to realize is how frequently does it happen? And that was the case. For me, it was happening too frequently. So I try to go out and seek the, attention of doctors.
Must have been pretty frightening for you.
It wasn't. For the longest time, I really couldn't get a diagnosis. I mean, I knew there was something wrong. I mean, that, you know, most of the doctors kept telling me I was stressed and depressed. Yet, in my own mind, I pretty much knew I wasn't, but I was relying on the medical community.
We do know our bodies. You know, we might not know the detail, but we do know our own bodies, and we know when something's wrong. You knew something was wrong. What happened when you got that diagnosis?
Well, I have to tell you, at first, it was such a great relief because, my God, it was almost 10 years that I was going through frustration trying to figure out what was going on. And by that time, I was really messing up all over the place. And it was great to finally be able to say to somebody, hey, the reason I've been doing this is because I have a medical condition. You know, this is why.
Yeah, that's a good news, bad news story, isn't it?
It is. I knew a little bit about what Alzheimer's was, but I didn't really have all the details. But as I found out more, to find out that there was no cure, that it basically meant you had a death sentence, I got to tell you, it was terrible. It was terrible. It really was.
You said was terrible or is terrible?
I live a little bit differently today. You know, there's nothing I can do to change the course. I mean, I could be negative about this. It ain't going to help. You have to try to look at it that, hey, this is an unfortunate fact of life that, you know, it's been given to me, and I got to try to make the best of what I have for as long as I can. It tears you apart every day just living with this disease in many different ways, but I can't focus on that because focusing on that will just make things worse.
Apropos of that, I was really struck. I read what you were doing and how you were doing it, and what struck me more than anything is people with dementia or you know, in my own case, when I forget things that I feel I should remember, there's this shame and embarrassment attached. And, I sometimes kind of fake it and nod my head and try to catch up. And you know, my first reaction is one of embarrassment. You're doing the opposite here with your disease. You're coming out. You're talking about it, writing about it.
You're right. There is a lot of embarrassment that goes along with it. I think I'm past the embarrassment. I still have those moments, But most people who I talk to know that I had the disease, so it makes it much easier to have those moments. But you're right. You know, you try to hide all that, and for a while I was very good at doing it, but you get to a point that you no longer can hide it because you're doing so bad. But you're right. You know, the problem with this disease, it's not like you have an arm or a leg cut off and people could feel sorry for you. And it's not that I want them to feel sorry for me, but I just want them to see what it's like to have the disease. And the sad part is most people look and see me talk, they think, my God, there's nothing wrong with this person. Just so much that is that people just don't see, and the pain that goes with it. And I'm hopefully trying to educate the rest of the world out there to see that side of it, which the majority of us are afraid to talk about.
So tell our audience what you want them to see about you and about this disease.
I have to tell you, we ourselves who are living with disease are probably our worst enemies, especially if you were a type A personality like I was, because we're constantly looking at ourselves of what we were capable of doing yesterday and how we're declining each day and no longer capable of doing it. Like I tell people, it's like you're becoming a child again. Things that were so simple and so easy to understand and do, you just can't do anymore. And every single day, it gets worse and worse. And there's just nothing you can do about it. You know, you would think that you could read something 3 or 4 or 5, 6, 7, 8 times to try to remember. And you just still, you can't remember it, even if your life depends on it, because you just can't retain it. It's things like that that is probably the worst enemy for this disease. I mean, there's a ton of things I can go on, but just that alone, I mean, the mental anguish that goes along with that. You know, people think that, oh, because you get this disease, you can't remember these things. Trust me, these people remember all this stuff that's going on. They may not be able to control it. They may not be able to figure out what they're trying to say, but in their mind, they know it's wrong. They just don't know how to be able to correct it.
You used the word wrong, and you said that, you know, you beat yourself up and you generalized it to others. Beating yourself up is because you're still expecting yourself to be what you were yesterday. And, you know, awful lot of people beat themselves up because they are not the people they were yesterday. And it does make all of our lives worse. You know, we hear this with the aging population, too. So I'll tell you what I heard and my reaction to you, Michael, if I may. You said you don't want sympathy, and of course you don't. But what you do want is understanding. And when I heard your voice, when you talked about what you talked about, and I heard your voice and the pain in that voice, my heart opened up. It's like I got it. I could connect with the fear, with the sadness, grief, frustration. I mean, isn't that what we all want, Michael? You know, we want somebody to understand us on the inside, what it's like to be us.
And that's true. And to be honest with you, the reason I want people to understand it is not necessarily probably for the right reasons, but for the reasons that I guess I want to see our government officials and people who can do something to have an impact on this to finally do something, because this disease is just, I feel it's being discriminated against. I really do. I mean, you look at AIDS and you look at, cancer, they're getting all this money for it. And don't get me wrong, they're just as important as any other disease. When you look at the funding, how they're being funded versus what we're getting for dementia, it's so lopsided. And part of it is because the people who have this disease aren't speaking up.
Tell us about your work. I was really, really blown away when I read about the work you're doing and who and how you've mobilized all these people.
Well, I'm involved in a lot of things. I'm involved in trying to reach. In fact, I'm the only person who's spoken at NAPA, the National Alzheimer's Project Act in Washington, D.C. I've spoken at every single one regularly. The only person who's living with this disease out of the whole United States, believe it or not, who's been at this thing.
Wow.
I've met with many congressmen and senators. I've even testified, you know, locally for Congress and senators. I've been on the Pennsylvania State Planning Committee for Alzheimer's. I'm doing all kind of things, trying to make awareness. I'm running a campaign for dementia, the purple angel, which is a symbol that's going to be hopefully used around the entire world to signify support for dementia. I'm doing training for trying to promote training for hospitals on how to treat people with dementia. The list goes on and on.
So as I'm listening, and the reason I'm laughing, Michael, is because a few minutes ago you said you were a type A personality, as though you're not one now. I'm hearing type A all over the place in what you're doing.
I know, it's scary when you think of what I could have really been able to still accomplish if I was running with a full deck, you know?
You said part of the message you wanted to get out is that you're different than you were, but you're still capable. And you said you're now capable of doing other things. What do you consider your strengths today that might not have been there before this diagnosis?
There's only one strength that I could actually say I'm better at today than I wasn't years ago. And it's kind of a funny one, because I was asked to speak in front of a large audience when I worked for my organization, and I told them they'd have to fire me because I would never get up in front of, like, it was 600 people. And today, I can stand up in front of 10,000, 20,000. It doesn't make a difference.
Why?
I feel comfortable standing up and talking to people. So if there's something this disease has done for me, and I don't know if it's the passion in me that's trying to make the difference that's overriding all that, but somehow that fear factor has gone away.
Has that passion been opened up for you? Were you a man of this much passion before the disease?
Well, I was always the type of person that if I saw something wrong, I always used to deal with CEOs throughout my life trying to improve products and things like that. I was always the type of person that if I saw there was a problem, I tried to address it. So, yeah, I think I always was that type of an individual.
Hmm. Michael, tell us about your family, your wife, children, parents. How are they doing?
Well, I have a wife and daughter. My daughter's 27. She's no longer living with us. She's doing very well herself. We really don't talk too much about this disease. She knows I have it and all. And my wife, she's actually a medical person. And you would think for somebody who's actually in the medical field, they would handle something like this much easier and better. But to be honest with you, I almost think that it's the complete opposite.
She's having difficulty with it?
Yeah, not only difficulty, but I also believe that When you're a nurse, and I hate to say this, but I think it goes along with any trait that you work in or trade, you become less sympathetic to what you're doing, and you have to. You kind of have to block things out because you're dealing with life and death every day, so you kind of become a little cold to things. So because of that, I believe I get that side of it, because she's not as attentive that she would probably be to a patient.
So you want more from her, and I just have a wild feeling she might want more from you also.
That's a possibility,
yeah.
And I could not blame her.
Yeah, it might be worth a conversation. Have you two talked about this?
I don't recall. I don't think so. You know, when it comes around this, you know, you have a lot of conversations outside, but you don't tend to have conversations with the people inside.
Yeah.
And I find this to be with everybody who's got this disease. We don't talk with our loved ones about it. We really don't.
Yeah, we're a strange species that way, aren't we?
Yeah.
Have you and your wife had conversations about the most difficult part of this disease, the end game?
Extensively. That was a subject that I wanted to talk to that my wife did not want to talk about. Her viewpoints were very different than mine. However, I have changed her mind that she agrees with my wishes, and my wishes is to not live life to the very end. My goal is to, and I don't know if this will be possible, but my goal is once I get to a certain point, which is pretty bad, that I hope I can take something that's going to end my life. But if I can't do it, I do have a lot of things put in place that's going to hopefully take care of my wishes that they stop feeding me.
Well, and I hope for your wife's sake, for your family's sake, that you've been very, very clear about what that point is. And that's often a difficult thing to talk about, even difficult to know. You know, what is that point? You know,
it is. And to be honest with you, the sad part is, if you have dementia, you really need a special, a special type of living will that is geared for dementia.
Wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, you do. And unfortunately, without it, there's so much that is overlooked. The second thing is, I don't know if you're aware of this, when you have dementia, you lose a lot of your civil rights. You are not allowed to make decisions anymore. You know, like if you're in a hospital, for example, and you had cancer and they needed to give you, you know, the morphine and things like that to kind of put you out of your misery, you can make that decision. As a person with dementia, you can't do that.
Well, that's certainly an important issue to follow up on. I'd like to know more at what point and how they determine what point. I mean, this that's really troubling what you said at one level. Another level, it kind of makes sense, but you know, it's troubling. Let me ask you just one final question. So we've talked about life and death and all you're trying to do, and we've talked about your pain and your suffering here. So how do you cope in the big picture?
Well, I think part of my way of coping is by doing my advocacy. I do that probably 7 days a week, at least 12, 14 hours a day. I think that keeps my mind off of things, and by doing it, it's actually therapeutic, because I believe just talking about it, just having conversations with people like you, you know, takes some of that out of me a little bit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a good side. Plus, at the same time, I also believe that's keeping my mind going, to have conversations like that. I think if I didn't have a purpose in life, which so sadly many of us end up doing, because you get ripped out of the workforce, you really have nothing left to do, it could become really depressing.
Michael, I got good news for you. You talked about how having this conversation with me was therapeutic. You didn't have this conversation with me. You had it with many thousands of people who were listening and learning and feeling as we were talking. So you've done a service to my audience, you've done a service to me, and you've done a service to what you believe most deeply in. So I want to thank you, Michael. Thank you for the time, and thank you for the work you're doing.
Well, I thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. That was Michael Ellenbogen, a remarkable young man. He's 53 now. He was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in his 40s. When we come back, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Gerald Hansen, Associate Director of Family Medicine Residency Program at Abington. He treats many people with Alzheimer's. Sarah Moss is a manager of the Mueller Institute for Senior Health at Abington Memorial Hospital. We'd love you to join the conversation. Our number is 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you if you have Alzheimer's or dementia, if a loved one does, or if you're treating someone for Alzheimer's or dementia. Again, 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at iamconcerned.org.
Proudly supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School with day and boarding options is dedicated to redefining what is possible for children and youth with special needs. Students not only contribute to their class communities, but the community as a whole. Taking part in festivals, starring in plays, caring for animals, participating on student council, and fulfilling meaningful roles in their on-campus homes. Offering campus tours on March 25th and April 29th at 9 a.m. Details at camphillspecialschool.org.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about Alzheimer's and various other dementias with Dr. Gerald Hansen and Sarah Moss. You know, after that remark, I listened again to that remarkable man. I got to ask you, Gerald, that doesn't sound like a man with Alzheimer's or what we picture as.
Sure, absolutely. And he's in the early stages. What comes across is the importance of meaning in one's life, that if you have meaning, you can go through almost anything. What also struck me was the fear and sort of the sadness that he's not going to have control over his ending. And he wanted a sense of that control through either physician-assisted suicide or his own suicide. And the other thing that struck me was a sense of shame that you spoke with and wife maybe at times not wanting to talk about it. And my mom had Alzheimer's, and it was very difficult for my dad to, number one, acknowledge it, number two, to share it with his friends. He wanted to hide it. He was embarrassed.
What was it like for you?
I think in some ways having the cloak of being a physician was somewhat protective in that you have that clinical role to play. But it was heartbreaking seeing my mom's decline. I had always prayed that something would take her before she got to the advanced stages of Alzheimer's. And I guess the blessing was given that she died probably early on in the moderate stage. Mm-hmm. And she was able to say goodbye to all her children, to all her grandchildren, died with my dad holding her hands. And so it was really a wonderful ending that way for her.
Hmm. And for you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What was your relationship like with your mom before all this started?
My mom was wonderful. She was always there. She was always caregiving to us, always a tremendous optimist. And I think in some ways she really didn't know that she had the disease as it progressed, and liked being taken care of. It was a nice switch. Perfect. When she had been the caregiver for so many years, and my dad did such a wonderful job of taking care of her, that it was really heartwarming to see that.
Hmm. I want to come back. You know, Michael Ellenbogen, in before we took our break, touched on so many issues here. He touched on the social. He touched on the political issues. He touched on caregiving themes. And he touched on some of the legal issues and touched on issues of suicide. So there's just talking about what he covered in a 17-minute interview was kind of remarkable. I want to turn to you, Sarah, and the program that you're manager of at Abington, did Michael inspire part of that?
No, we had the Mueller Institute since 1999. The program that we're, the virtual dementia tour and the dementia training that we're doing with the staff was definitely inspired by Michael. He came to us about a year and a half ago and said, I've been in the hospital. It's not a pleasant experience. I want hospitals to start looking at what they're doing with dementia patients. Would you be that hospital?
What happened in the hospital? I don't know if to direct it to you, Sarah, or you, Gerald.
What happened to Mike?
To his hospitalization, yeah.
He felt that people didn't understand that he had dementia. They looked at him as if he, like he said, had a full deck, and he didn't. He was talked over. He was talked around. He couldn't advocate for himself, and so things happened to him, and he was labeled when he spoke up. He was not in control of his hospitalization, and he didn't feel like he had a good advocate to help him.
Which these days everybody needs.
Absolutely.
So tell us about the program that he did inspire.
Well, he came to us with a program already designed. It was a 3-hour mandatory program that was designed by somebody from the Alzheimer's Foundation, the University of Pennsylvania, the Phoebe Institute, and then there was this thing called the Virtual Dementia Tour. We talked to a program in a hospital in Florida who had done both. They said that they had done the training first and the Virtual Dementia Tour second and thought that it was best to reverse that. So we, at this time, when the hospital in Florida did it, was about 5 or 6 years ago when hospitals were a little more flush. We couldn't make it mandatory. We couldn't do 3 hours. It just, when you look at the costs involved in that, they're just overwhelming. So we did the Virtual Dementia Tour in November. It's very labor intensive. We had to have 5 people helping you through the tour. It's kind of like a sensitivity training, like instant aging, but with a few other components that help you understand what it might feel like to have dementia.
How can you help somebody understand what it's like?
Well, there's a room set up. You have tasks that you have to complete. You're given the task once. You're not allowed to ask questions afterwards. You go into this room. It's dark. You have headphones on that have all kinds of competing noise. And you have to complete these tasks. And it becomes very frustrating because you can't remember. You're under pressure. You can't remember what the tasks were. You can't find the things that you need to complete the tasks. You're embarrassed that you can't do simple tasks like folding clothes or things like that. And you're annoyed by this the noise in the headphones and not being able to feel correctly. It's just very frustrating.
I should say, Sarah, and to our listeners, that we've got a link to the virtual tour, virtual dementia, on our website. So please check it out there. I want to talk about diagnosis and early diagnosis. And I'm directing this, obviously, to you, Gerald. How do you know? How do you begin to know? When do you suspect?
Oftentimes it takes a while until somebody's really willing to look at the possibility. And oftentimes it's a family member that brings the individual in that has concerns. There are neuropsychiatric tests that you can do that can help delineate whether or not you have dementia or Alzheimer's dementia. There are many mental status exams that you can do as a physician that can give you a sense of whether somebody has it or not. You can have sometimes MRI imaging. But the gold standard, unfortunately, is biopsy, and we don't do brain biopsies.
Right. And you know, MRI is probably the second best, but that's really a fortune. I want to know, you know, we've got a lot of people listening who wonder.
Sure.
You know, do I? So how do we know, before we even go to you, what do we usually see or suspect?
The brain is a remarkable, remarkable organ. It has 700 billion neurons. Each has 1,000 connections. So you're talking about 7 trillion connections in the brain.
And it's, give or take.
Yeah. And it's wonderful how it works. You have a part of your brain called the hippocampus, which is sort of the keyboard where you enter in your memories. So part of the early diagnosis is that short-term memory impairment. But you also have to have a language impairment or a visual-spatial impairment.
So what's that mean?
Language would be they're forgetting words, the structure of their sentences is off, sort of circumlocution. They will be wandering in their conversation and sometimes coming back to it. The visual spatial, the examples would be intersecting pentagons. Can you draw that? Or can you draw the face of a clock and put the numbers on? So it's that combination of – it's not just short-term memory, but it's the others as well that would lead you to the diagnosis.
By that time, you might be pretty far down the road, yes, with Alzheimer's, or is that still considered mild?
Well, there's something called mild clinical impairment, which is sometimes considered pre-Alzheimer's. Probably anywhere from 10 to 15% will convert over to Alzheimer's each year. The importance of trying to find out perhaps if someone starts to have the signs or are already starting to have some of the manifestations of it that are subclinical, is are there interventions that can be done at that point to prevent its progression?
And?
Maybe.
Oh,
maybe.
Go on.
In terms of prevention, exercise is very, very helpful, and it doesn't take a lot of exercise. If you can do 10, 15 minutes a day of just walking, that gives you a significant amount of protection. If you stop exercising, that starts to wane. There's also something called neuroaerobics, which is basically exercises for the brain, and there's some businesses that do that. But picking up a new language, picking up a musical instrument, doing some of the puzzles and things like that, learning new skills. It used to be thought that you were born with all the brain cells you're ever going to have, and then it's just going to be picked off as time goes on. There's something called neuroplasticity. You can build new neurons, and that can be very helpful. And stress is also critical. Obviously, as we get older, oftentimes there are more stressors. Probably the main physiologic change as we get older is our inability to respond to stress the way it was when we were younger. So stress management is critical, and included in that, and I know you're a devotee of meditation, is absolutely wonderful for people.
Although I know many older people who get more mellow as they age.
We would hope.
What, for ourselves?
Maybe for her significant others.
for everyone. Let's go to the phones. We've got Joe on the line. Joe?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi, Dan.
What can we do for you, Joe?
Okay. I have a family history of Alzheimer's. My mother passed away from complications of having Alzheimer's. She had it for about 7 years, and she was young, passed away at 66. Her mother passed away, again, from complications of Alzheimer's, and she had it for about 8 years herself. I'm 44, and it was, I do have, I've always been challenged with some short-term memory issues, and quite frankly, I'm a little bit concerned that I'm next in line. And I want to know how I should go about finding out if I do have early onset. Because my short-term memory does seem to be getting a bit worse. And, it just worries me.
Can I ask you a couple of questions?
Yes.
Before we turn to the people who actually know what they're talking about?
Sure.
So what would change in your life if you did have early onset? What would change in your life?
Well, what would change? I'm not sure. I guess it would be maybe a confirmation of something I'm worried about, and
you see what
I'm not sure. I'm not sure how to answer that. And, I have kids right now. I have a 17, a 14, and a 13-year-old, and I can't even believe I'm talking about this, but it's always lingering in the back of my mind. And any time that I do lose my keys or something, I don't remember a lot from my childhood. I don't have a lot of memories that I can pull forward. There's certain things, but my wife, for instance, she remembers everything. She remembers the birthday and where they were.
Oh, God, please don't ever compare yourself to anybody else, because that's just going to wind up being painful. But we're going to turn to Dr. Hansen in one second. But just please keep in mind my question of what would be different, maybe inside of you, if you did have the diagnosis. And just think about it. Would you spend more time with your kids? Would you spend more time doing X? Would you spend less time doing something else? So just think about those things. And Dr. Hansen.
First of all, sorry for the loss of your mother. And I hear certainly understandable fear in your voice. The question is, as Dan put forth, would you live your life differently? And there's a condition called Huntington's chorea, which is genetic, and they are able to test for it. And people that had Huntington's chorea in their family were given the option of having that test.
Genetic test.
And it came through either positive or negative. And regardless of whether it was positive or negative, the individuals that were tested were happy in a great majority that they had that testing. I think it's worth certainly seeing your family physician, seeing your primary care physician. There can be a number of conditions that can mimic dementia that are reversible.
And is there a genetic test for early onset?
There is a genetic test for early onset. So you can look for some genes that may or may not be associated with what his mom had.
So the rule of thumb in general, if you're anxious about something, you call your doctor and you know, address what it is you're anxious about. Joe, I do wish you the best and appreciate your call and your openness. We're going to have to take just a short break now. We're talking with Dr. Gerald Hansen. He's the Associate Director of Family Medicine Residency Program at Abington and treats many, many patients with Alzheimer's. Sarah Moss is Manager of the Mueller Institute for Senior Health at Abington Memorial Hospital. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Supporting WHYY, Intervention Associates, a nonprofit Quaker-based organization, provides care management and guardianship services for people of all ages. Services include home care, community services, crisis intervention, and patient advocacy. Intervention Associates navigates all available health care options and medical benefits. Clients receive a professional needs assessment and detailed care plan. Details available at interventionassociates.org.
I'm Robin Young. Doctors at the Mayo Clinic are paid in salaries, not fees, and they work in groups. Look at the view from the top from the CEO.
I think it's really the culture that works at Mayo Clinic. It's that team-based patient-centeredness that really drives us forward.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about the dementias with Sarah Moss. She's manager of the Mueller Institute. I pronounced it right for the first time. I'm so proud of myself. At Abington Memorial Hospital. We're also joined by Dr. Gerald Tripp Hansen. He's Associate Director of Family Medicine and Residency there. So, you know, a lot of issues have come up, and I guess the one that I'm really curious about is alternative therapies. I mean, you know, Gerald, you talked about meditation. We've got a lot of callers who want to know about food, diet, diet that both helps and harms the brain. Do we know anything? Is there any real research out there? Either of you know?
What I think is the most important alternative therapy is socialization. We have something called the Memory Fitness Center at Abington for people in the early stages of cognitive decline. And we find that guests getting out and being with other people and being social makes a huge difference, not only in the life of the person with the disease, but in the life of the caregiver.
Hmm. Yeah, I want to talk about caregivers. Let me just check in with you, Dr. Hansen. We've known each other for many years now, and I don't know whether to call you Tripp, which is what I always call you.
Call me Tripp,
or
please.
Or Gerald. Okay. Yeah. Whew, that was uncomfortable. So, Tripp, are you familiar with any diets that help, that can help prevent?
Certainly, alcohol minimum, no tobacco. A healthy diet is certainly very helpful. You don't want to become obese. If you have central obesity, there's inflammation that occurs throughout the body, which accelerates aging, including the aging of your brain. So taking good care of yourself. Stress is clearly an element.
But what about food extracts? I mean, I read ginkgo, I read, has been disproven, yes?
Correct.
So is there anything that has been proven to be helpful?
No.
Nothing.
In terms of foods. I've tried them all. None of them work.
I want to talk to both of you about caregivers, and this is a critical issue here. You've been, Tripp, and Sarah, I guess you've been with people who are getting the diagnosis live at the moment. What happens? I mean, how do they respond? How do they cope in the short run? And, well, I'll tack on a third question. What do caregivers need to know?
It's overwhelming in many ways to caregivers. It's oftentimes the spouse. If it's not the spouse, usually it's one of the daughters or the daughter. And it is tremendously draining and frustrating on so many levels. There's a book called The 36-Hour Day, which describes all the different things that are that overwhelm them and ways to help manage them. I have been absolutely humbled by the caregivers of those that have Alzheimer's disease. The amount of love, the compassion, the courage that they have is phenomenal, as it is with the patients. There's some patients with Alzheimer's that have insight in that it is happening. They tend to have depression. There's another subset that they don't have the insight, so they tend to become more paranoid, more aggressive, more combative, and that they're correct and everybody else is wrong.
That's interesting. Sarah, you care for caregivers.
I do.
What do they need? What do they need to know?
They need a support group. They need to know that there are other people who are going through situations like theirs, some worse, some better. They need to be able to talk about it. They need to not hide the fact that they're caring for someone with dementia, and they need to be able to ask for help.
Hmm. Yeah, that's hard for so many people.
It is.
We've got a somebody on the line. We don't have time to take her call, but she's an art therapist. Hmm. And you talked about socialization, but I've read an awful lot about art and music helping patients with Alzheimer's. Any research on that? Do you have it?
It is a different part of the brain. There's some research done with drums. And nursing homes, they get a giant kettle drum that's fluted at the bottom, and the people put their feet at the bottom. And people just bang to their heart's content, and it's very therapeutic for them.
Hmm.
We have art therapy at one of the retirement communities, Winco Church Home, where I'm the medical director. And some of this art is phenomenal that these people are able to produce.
I was at a daycare center years ago, and there was a woman who was virtually mute and, you know, just sat there looking at a wall, and they led her over to a piano, and she played incredibly and sang beautifully to what she was playing.
It's amazing how some of those holes of preserved function are there. We had a patient in the hospital who had advanced dementia. It really was nonverbal. And I was rounding during the week, and then on the weekend, one of the residents said, "Watch this." and he said to the patient, "Sing Danny Boy." And he sang in a beautiful Irish tenor. The nurses were coming in the room. Tears were coming down their eyes. It was just remarkable to see that.
What remains in the brain and in the heart. I want to talk about what, coming back to Abington, Sarah, what resources are there for people with Alzheimer's and their families?
We have a great continuum of care at Abington. We have a geriatric assessment center where people often come and get the first diagnosis of Alzheimer's, and then we can refer them to our memory fitness center, which actually has an art therapist who comes once a week and a music therapist who runs one of the programs. We've also been working with Arcadia University. We read Shakespeare with the students from a drama class. And we have a home care department that's very sensitive to people with dementia. And while you're in the hospital, we have something called the Hospital Elder Life Program. We're the only people in the hospital who don't care what you have. We just care who you are because we aren't medical. We can't do anything about what you have anyway. But we are advocates for older people in the hospital. If they have glasses, we make sure they're clean. If they have a hearing aid, we make sure their batteries are in. We make sure they get up and are walking. We make sure they know who they are, where they are, why they are where they are. And we can bring puzzles and games and newspapers and...
I think when you leave, I'm going to write you and your program a check for $10 million.
We would love that.
So now tell me, well, I'm taking it out of your salary.
But good luck.
So tell me what you would do differently. I was really struck when you said earlier on that original program had to get cut out. The original training of the residents had to get cut out for financial reasons. What would you bring into the program if you didn't have to worry about funds or bosses for that matter?
Well, it's not just that. There are a lot of competing issues in a hospital. Dementia is just one of them. But the hospital is not a friendly place for people with dementia. There was a white paper written by somebody. Committee that Michael works on, then one of the top things it says is keep your loved one out of the hospital. And I would, loved ones are going to have to come to the hospital, so I would love to be the kind of place where you feel safe.
What needs to change for that to happen? And I'll direct it to both of you. You're trying to turf this off the trip, I can
no,
see.
People need more time. That, somebody with dementia, it takes time to care for somebody with dementia. You have to sit and wait for an answer. You have to ask the right questions. You have to be ready to interpret behavior. And it takes time. And, the way the hospitals work these days, everybody's in a hurry. So I would love for people to have more time.
Yeah, in general, that would make medicine in general better. Tripp?
What I oftentimes try to model for the residents or ask the residents, find out what this person was like. How many children did they have? What were their hobbies? What were their passions? What was their profession? And see them as individuals. And if you can connect with them and see that individual, that compassion comes out.
So the question you ask them, though, has to be your kind of question, not my kind, where I would ask, what's it like on the inside? That's too abstract. They need concrete questions.
Sometimes, if they are able to articulate what it's like, it is powerful. It is powerful. And having any kind of a glimpse into it, and that's what Michael's been so wonderful at giving, you don't look at them as the Alzheimer's patient. You look at the patient who happened to have Alzheimer's disease.
Michael brought up the issue of suicide. It was brought up in the film Ask Alice, where Julianne Moore, who played Alice, made a video when she had early onset, talking to Alice, who was later on more involved. So what about that?
I'll start with the story, and then I'll tell you some of my feelings on physician-assisted suicide. A therapist had a patient who had cared for both parents that had Alzheimer's, had cared for older siblings that had Alzheimer's. came to him in her early 50s because she was afraid that she was really coming down with Alzheimer's and wanted to kill herself. And he said, okay, I hear that, but let's talk about it. Now you finally have a chance to live your life. You don't have that those responsibilities. And he said, how about if we get you a prescription for Seconal, which is a sleeping pill, which is lethal. And what she did was she put it in a jar, put it up on the mantle, and put a sign next to it and said, if you can't remember what these pills are for, please take them. And it gave her a sense of control that they were able to move on with trying to live her life the best that she could.
Did she take the pills?
I don't know. They were still on the mantle last time I talked to him. The physician-assisted suicide is either legal or not prosecuted in four states, Washington, Oregon, Vermont, and Montana. There's potential, obviously, for abuse of that. I've been very happy to see that there have not really been abuses for that. It does give people a sense of control over the uncontrollable.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, and we've got a ton of callers who wanted to join the conversation. I invite you all to check out our website. We've got lots of resources there for you. Earlier on, we heard from Alzheimer's patient and advocate Michael Ellenbogen. We're also have been talking with Gerald Tripp Hansen and Sarah Moss, both from Abington Hospital. Well, you can follow us at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. Our email address is voices@whyy.org. And my email address is drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Zakiya Gibbons is our intern. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends. And we're going to go out with a very special song from Glenn Campbell.
I'm still here, but yet I'm gone. I don't play guitar or sing my songs. It never defined who I am.